is Kelly Lally, and I'm here outside Russellville, Indiana, with Mr. Donald Hazlett. Today is August the 20th, 1987. When were you born, Mr. Hazlett?
Where or when?
When and where?
I was born August the 20th, 1905.
1905.
This is my birthday.
Well, happy birthday. I didn't know.
Thank you.
Where were
you? So that makes me 82.
Happy birthday again. That's great. Where were you born?
In the house right south of us here.
Here in Russellville. And you basically, besides your work, have you lived here all your life?
Oh, yes. This has always been voting precinct.
Ah. Well, how many people were in your family?
I had one sister.
And was your father a farmer? Or?
Yeah. My father was basically a farmer. Although he in his day he was trained as a steam engineer, thrashing machine, anything to do with steam locomotive, and I don't know just where they gave a course someplace out of Purdue or someplace that he took that.
How did you get interested in geology?
I went to the University of Illinois, and of course when I first matriculated over at the University of Illinois, I was in the engineering school, electrical engineering, because when I was still in high school, I went to the Westinghouse Electric and worked in their research lab. At that time, there was only one radio station in the United States, and that was KDKA. And I heard of that, and there was no voice communication then. It was all dots and dashes. And so I went out seeking to see what I could get on. So I got on as a research assistant and worked with C.R. Hanna. He was a Purdue graduate, the Hanna Crossing down here where 36 and 231 crosses. That land was all owned by the Hannas. And C.R., of course, was instrumental in trying to get me to be an engineer. But then when you get into your college classes and take various classes, well, then you drift into other interests. And it was through that angle that I got interested, and I got to know very well, or maybe my professor got to know me fairly well, Francis Parker. Can't think of his last name now.
Shepherd.
He was from the East Coast, and he was doing his doctorate, and the summer he was taking doing his work in the on the Rocky Mountain Trench in Canada, and by the time summer came around, he, I guess, knew me well enough to ask me to go along as his field assistant. So I went into that, and then went on and got my degree there. And then another one of my professors, Dr. Arthur Bevan, later became I stuttered around here too much. State geologist of Virginia, and all out of a clear sky. This brings me into the Park Service now. One night I got a call and wanted to know what I was doing, and I said I was working on my master's degree, and he said, would you like to start working for the Park Service? And I said, well, how could I work for the Park Service? I don't have a civil service exam, never taken one or anything. They were just out of it. And in fact, he called me from Washington there was a, they had a governor's conference there, and he attended that, and at that time they didn't have a geologist on the staff at Washington in the National Park Service. So he said, well, we don't have anybody in mind, and I know you can do it, and there's nobody on the civil service roll, so we can waive it. They want no one we could start, so we just got in the car with it. So there we were. And so there I was in the Washington office. Do you want to ask more?
No, go ahead. Just tell me how you started working in the field.
Then, future national parks have always been a troublesome thing to get. Now, here's two parallels. The Great Smokies. Few people were involved, just timber companies, and a few people living in those little coves. That's all. See, very few people. So they don't give you much trouble. But Mammoth Cave coming along, that was an entirely different ball of worms. The people that were guides there, they were second and third generation people. They knew very little of the cave as a whole. They knew one avenue. If you wanted to see a certain part of the cave, it was Cutliff or somebody, you know, he'd take you there. And that was just it. And the general, now those are all wonderful people down there. I don't want anything to ever come out of this tape to say it's not.
I know.
See?
I know what you're saying.
And then it was a question up in the office. We knew they were nearing the land acquisition, and we knew that, I'm speaking now from headquarters, and we debated this many times, how are we going to do it? What, how can we sue this thing over? And we knew that even though the guides were hardworking and had always worked there, they it wasn't that they weren't telling the truth.
They were just limited.
It was what knowledge they had. And if they look down the avenue and that's a duck, well, that's what it looks like, see, and whatnot. We needed to brush that up just a little, and not to change it, not to change the flavor of the trip, but to get the information on a little more solid base. So there was no way a National Park Service employee could go down there and say, we're going to work you over. So we decided that my wife and I would go down looking for work. So we got in our little Ford, went down to Cave City. We didn't go out to the park. We went to Cave City and asked around, is there any work? No, it's too late to pick tobacco worms, and nobody was doing anything, and that was about the only work there was. You know, they were just finishing after that. So we rented us a little apartment above the drugstore there in Main Street of Cave City. And in the afternoons, I'd be talking to people, sit on the bench down there, the boys from Mammoth Cave would come in. I met them all, and well, what you guys are doing? Well, we don't have any work. We're looking for work. And they'd tell me somebody might want something. I'd go see them, everything. And quite a little time went on, and they apparently liked me. We didn't come in going to run the place. We were honest people coming in looking for work. So the boys went out and talked to Marty Charlet. He was cave manager at that time. And a very personable person of French extension and extraction. And so they said if I thought I'd go out and talk to him, he could give me a job. So I was got to work around the parking lot doing things like that, you know. So as you knew these guides as they finished their day's work, and in effect they were jealous of each other, jealous of what they knew in their area of the cave as opposed to somebody else their area of the cave. So I found myself working 24 hours a day. Now would you go with me tonight and I'll show you some real cave. So that night we'd go with Nancy. Well then the other guy, now you went with, you go with me. So and in later years there, Marty Charlet said outside of himself that I had been in more avenues of Mammoth Cave than any other living person. And I think that's true today, because the guides that are there now haven't been any place, see? And all these old guides had never been in these others. So as far as I know, I still have that distinction of having been in more avenues in Mammoth Cave than any other living person.
That's good, we're getting you on tape then.
So it worked out real well. And then in the meantime, I would go with these guides with as they went on the trip. And I took with me Marty Charlet's secretary, and she took down in shorthand everything they said. Everything they said. Then it was up to me to keep the flavor of that. And brush out what they could. Now these guys were not resentful to changing the mineral they were talking about. They were glad to know really what it was, see. So it wasn't, they were just, that's what they'd been told. Mm-hmm. And so then what evolved out of that whole thing was that I developed a guidebook for each trip that they were showing at that time. Now those are all out of date now, because they don't even show those trips as such now. Mm-hmm. But it was through that each one of them had. And later, some years later, I went down there and we were talking with one of the guides there then. Oh yes, he said, we still use your guidebook. They had it down in their lockers. But to go back just a little bit then, I left, of course, the management out of Washington was down. They had other assignments for me, you know. So it worked out that they got me on in Washington again. So then the next time I went back, well, we had our government car.
Oh, and excuse me for just a second. The first time you went was about what time, what year? Do you remember?
First time we went was in 1930, was it 7 or 8?
I think 37.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then we went back to Washington after about 6 months. And then we were there 38, a part of 38 and 39.
Okay.
And it was during that summer of 38 that we were hashing up the possibility of a new discovery. And going down the river, and the guides built boats. We had to have 3 boats. Have you heard that story?
No.
We had it. That river was very treacherous. And during rainy seasons, the cavern was full of water, and you couldn't get out. So you had to protect yourself. And you couldn't get all the way down the river in one boat. It was the rock falls. So they had to build 3 boats progressively to get to where we were going. And as I remember, I was notified when they were exploring, and I was notified that they found their way in, and then I was assigned to go in and make the preliminary report on the new discovery. And if I'm not mistaken, it was in October 1939 that I made my first trip in there. And that was exactly 1 year from the time they made the first discovery, which was in 38. And at that time, I was doing work down on Cape Hatteras, the national park down there on the water supply. And they notified me. And then the time element comes in there, and you got to work these things out. But before we went in to really explore, and the cave engineer down there had made preliminary surveys, and they drilled a hole, a well, down into the cave, so that if we were trapped in there, they could feed us. So Florida would send our sandwiches down and our light bulbs and everything, but we were never really trapped, but just in case. Now, from the historic entrance back into this, what we call the new discovery now, is I logged in there. It took us 18 hours, and that's a long trip.
Yeah.
In there. So, any more questions there?
Go ahead.
So out of that, out of that whole episode, I suppose we've always felt that we injected in there a lot of goodwill between the Park Service and the management in there, and that we were very well accepted.
Well, that's good. I know that there have been a lot of problems, even with the local residents.
Oh, yes, yes. And so many of those guides had a lot of families, and they spoke good words for us, so we weren't foreigners anymore, mm-hmm. and we were part of it.
Did they say anything when you came back with your government car? You were talking about that earlier after.
Oh, they know, yes. You see, they knew that when we left, I was to be assigned to Washington.
Oh, okay.
See?
I didn't think that you were there earlier.
It worked out fine.
Oh, good.
And can you kick that off?
Sure. So you went to Mammoth Cave about 3 times, you say?
Oh, we were in and out many times.
In and out many times.
Yeah. Because basically, that was, now, my assignment with the Washington office was a very unique assignment. I was a troubleshooter, and my travel order read continental United States and island possessions. And I was given an open-ended budget to do what I might be in one state and 2 or 3 states had to take care of, that is water wells and road bank, road materials and whatnot, that I would be called on, and I'd just go ahead and do it, see. So I was the only one that that had such an assignment. Well, in fact, the matter is, working out of the Washington office, basically no one had a private car. I mean, assigned to them. Mm-hmm. It was this pool car business. And it didn't take me long to tell them, now if I'm going to do this, I've got to have a car that I can depend on, that I service, that I see that's going. So they said, well, if we order you a new car for yourself, you'll have to drive it 100,000 miles before you can get another one. And I said, well, that's no trouble the way I do it. So then, back then, filling stations closed up at night. And with the schedule I had, a lot of times I'd drive all night to get to a certain area, you know, or most of it, and sleep a couple of hours. So we had to get permission from the FBI to have a second gas tank put in the car. So I had a better cruising range in there. So I was in and out of Mammoth Cave just on any kind of a schedule that they wanted.
So you worked, you went through the new discovery, you kind of plotted it out, is that what you did part of it, or?
Yes.
And worked with the guidebooks, you know, developed the guidebooks while you were there. What exactly did you test the different, I'm not sure, I mean, I know that you went through, what else did you do while you were there, or is that the sum of it, or?
That was basically,
I don't know what a geologist does.
Well, didn't you help lay out some trails?
Oh, yes.
Nature trails.
Yes.
And roads, some roads, road material, because they had an engineer to lay out the roads.
Yeah. And in fact, I was instrumental in starting the naturalist program, surfers, and they built an amphitheater down by the hotel, and at times I was there while I'd give lectures down there on geology, you know, in the evening people would sit out on those. And I was rather pleased the last time I was down there. Was that 2 years ago or 3 years ago?
No, it was just a year ago. It won't be a year till last September.
And that's when the superintendent, I hadn't met the superintendent, but he heard that I was, well, I had made arrangements with the hotel there to be there, and they had told the superintendent I was coming. And so when I went in to see him, he had my report on this new discovery on his desk. And
it was written how many years ago? 40 years ago.
And he had it on my desk. And I says, well now, what has been done about showing that? What has developed in that? I was worried about that. He says, just exactly like you recommended. It is never to be open to the public.
That's what Ray Scott told me.
Yeah, and only scientific minded people can go in there, and they go in under strict supervision of a guides or two or three, and they have to walk exactly where we walked.
Oh, that's great.
In a 16-inch path.
So you were really instrumental down there.
Because it's one place. It's the one cave in the world that man had never been in.
One that we know.
Well, nobody's been able to dispute it. That you see those boots in that picture over there?
Mm-hmm.
That was my frontispiece in my report on that new discovery. And the wordage under that, man walks on untrodden earth and carries light to a realm which has been forever dark.
Nice.
Now it's hard to find.
Yes. Well, let's see. Did you come into contact with the Civilian Conservation Corps very much while you were working? They were working at the same time you were there.
They were working at the same time I was there. I basically had, knowledge that they were there and they were working on trails in there, and I see him work.
But they were under the jurisdiction of the Army.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was with the National Park Service, so they had very little.
There was no overlapping of.
He worked with an architect, and it was that architect was Tommy Nelson,
mm-hmm.
and he designed all the structures above ground. Tommy Nelson, and he worked with the chief ranger, that was Fred Benoist. I don't know if you've heard of him or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the superintendent at that time was Mr. Hoskins.
Taylor Hoskins.
Taylor Hoskins, yes.
Yeah.
And I can't think of the other people.
Well,
we knew Tommy.
Yeah, you want to click that again.
Okay. So after your work with Mammoth Cave, when were you completed with your work at Mammoth Cave? When did you finish that?
Never.
Never.
I haven't done anything very recently there. I suppose the last real project I did was write the report on the new discovery,
mm-hmm.
and whatnot. Of course, I don't, when I go down there now, I don't do much caving because I do have an artificial hip now.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't lay a lot of walking.
Yeah.
And whatnot. But of course, then my work went to just the other areas, and I was the only geologist that had a broad assignment, and as I say, my travel order read continental United States and island possessions. They were just writing too many travel orders, and of course, having a car that really wasn't assigned to a pool, it was a question when I was in headquarters what to do with it. In other words, where do you put it?
Mm-hmm.
And so they conceived the idea that, there's plenty of room over in the White House garage, why don't you take it in there? But I think today, how how impossible that would be with the security.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't get anywhere near.
I just drive in there and wave to the guards and take it down there. And I'd have my car sitting down there beside the limousines, and we'd kid each other about them washing up my car for me and whatnot. Things that
This is the second side of my tape with Mr. Donald Hazlett. Yeah, as you were saying, times have changed.
The, of course, rather an interesting offshoot there when Oak Ridge was being conceived as a research site for the developing the atomic bomb. I was assigned, there were no buildings out there then, and they gave me an office in TVA, personnel office, and I was assigned to recruit and hire engineers to do that work. And I had signature authorization, not on the top engineers, but an engineer that would be drawing $2,000 or $3,000 a year. That was a pretty good salary for a young engineer coming out of college at that time. And I hired hundreds of those before we got Oak Ridge going, and they had personnel office of their own. And then with the war coming on there, although we as the United States were not in it, we were involved in sending aircraft to England. They were all crated and sent on commercial ships and whatnot. And at that time, the Corps of Engineers were having problem of getting water for their Caribbean bases, which was even thinking far enough ahead that we might have to carry out this African invasion. That's the reason we were going that way, I remember. And of course, even loaned to the Corps of Engineers, they were supposed to furnish me transportation from wherever I was between Puerto Rico and Trinidad. And there was a plane came out of Puerto Rico in the morning and went to Trinidad and came back. And but historically, the the largest airplane we had at that time was the B-24. That looks like a little one at the present time. But they were training pilots on those B-24s on the island of St. Croix. And we used to take our, we had the right to go out to the mess hall to eat, living there on the island. And so the captain knew my, he says, well, why don't you just arrange your schedule and not make it known just where you're going that day? And after the plane's gone, why, you arrange your schedule to go the other way, and we have to fly these planes, so we'll go wherever you want to go. So that was my schedule. I had to, maybe telling the day before, we'd go in opposite direction. And there I was, just a civilian riding a B-24. And Now, really, that created quite a stir when we'd go into the International Airport at Puerto Rico, and just a little old me get out and walk out, and that plane wait on me. And but if I stayed all night, and I remember one night I stayed all night there in the hotel at Puerto Rico, but the personnel on the B-24 couldn't stay there. They went to there was an air base on the west end of Puerto Rico. So in the early morning, airs, I heard some commotion down in the harbor there, and I looked out, and our fleet was going on silence, I know, on radar, and they were signaling with lights, and they all went out duck fashion, and so then when the plane came in to pick me up at the airport, the captain says, "Well, where'd the fleet go? We heard it went out." And I said, "Well, I was going to ask you where it went." I said, "They took off about 3 o'clock in the morning and went. They went to the northeast, and of course, you always have to be just a little various to how you say things." I said, "What's your schedule?" And, "Well, it's your schedule. We're flying you." And I said, "Well, I couldn't just say, well, let's go hunt the fleet." I said, "I believe there's some islands off to the northeast I'd like to look at while they're here." So we took off, and I was laying down on the mat in the front gunner's bubble on the B-24, and the captain called down to me on his speaker. He says, "You can see him ahead?" And I said, "No, I can't." He said, "Well, we'll soon be where you can." And there was our fleet. So then we had to identify ourselves. So the captain radioed the commander of the fleet who we were, and he says, "Well, come on over." And so we flew over there. Here was a German submarine trying to get in position to sink that merchant ship that was loaded with airplanes.
Wow.
And our fleet was duck flashing around the commercial to keep the submarine away, and to keep so it couldn't.
Yeah.
Now whatever happened, I could never confirm, but it was published in the paper that there was an oil slick in the.
Well, you had some adventures.
So that was fun. Because we got to fly right down over the ships, you know, and the B-24, and that was right nice.
What did you do during World War II?
Kept on working with the, on those special assignments, mm-hmm. you know, and taking those in.
Have you traveled all over the United States then?
Oh, yes.
Both of you, did you take your wife everywhere?
we went. Of course, I lived in the apartment, whatever we had. I didn't go out on investigating.
But we had a rather a unique arrangement, with an arrangement like I had. I had permission that my wife could go with me on any trip. She could ride in a government vehicle anytime, and we could stay wherever we wanted to. That was rather unique, and a lot of them were envious of that sort of thing. I have a fireplace in there that has the rocks from all over the United States in it.
I see that. That's the second one of those I've seen in the last 2 weeks, and that's the only two I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, right. And
what's your favorite place that you've been?
Home.
Well, what's your favorite job that you've done?
Well, that would really be hard to say. I suppose I'm a little unique in that respect. I have enjoyed all the jobs I've done. Of course, they would get monotonous after a fashion, but I suppose the challenge is just, well, you just take that little instance there in Puerto Rico. That was a rather satisfying experience in just being able to pull out of a hat something concrete, make a solution, see, mm-hmm. and whatnot.
We usually stayed at least 6 months in a place, mm-hmm. as in Richmond or North Carolina and Florida and different places, and not over a year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe, well, in Knoxville we stayed over a year,
mm-hmm.
but it was usually short assignments.
And then use that as a temporary headquarters and work out of that.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you work for the government doing these different projects all over the country and so forth?
Oh, that'd be hard to figure out.
Well, I imagine 20 years.
20 years. Mm-hmm. What did you do after you?
We came back to the farm here, and basically because our son needed to get in school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I taught school over at our local school district, and I hadn't been here too long until they came to ask me if I would, and I said, well, I've set up to farm here. I was going to do some farming, and well, they thought I'd be more valuable teaching school, so I taught school until retirement age.
What level did you teach?
Industrial arts.
Industrial arts, a high school?
Yes.
The high school?
Oh, yeah.
Huh, that's an interesting. After all the, yeah, were you able to bring in some of your experiences?
Well, I suppose some of them would say I brought them in too much. Now, in that I was able to build in the shop equipment where I could saw rocks, and my students could saw rocks and make bookends and paperweights and things like that. And take them home, and but I was always picking up, trying to get by on the equipment I had, and I would raise some broom corn here, and the kids in the junior high could make brooms and so on for their
mm-hmm.
families. And so I enjoyed it very much. I suppose now over there on the TV, now there's those bookends are made from petrified wood from the petrified forest.
Oh.
And
you've had quite a few opportunities. You say you've been back to Mammoth Cave several times since you
oh, yes.
stopped work there. What do you think of the park and the cave now?
Well, it of course it's grand. I'm glad it went the way it did, and
Well, the most disappointing thing to me last September, because when we were there about 5 years ago, they had a lovely museum where that visitor center is. It was just grand. And why, there's not a piece of it left. I don't know where they stored it or where they threw it over the hill.
We were wondering about that while you were out there.
I think they're trying to make a new, or they're trying to develop a new one, but it hasn't gotten off the ground yet.
Well, no, and asking people, they had a can there to put in your nickels and dimes to do that. Do they still have that, asking for donations?
I haven't noticed it, but that's not something I probably would have noticed.
Well, I noticed that right off and looking around where they put those lovely exhibits.
They want to make a whole new building for it, is what they want to do.
Uh-huh. Well, I think they should have kept the old one until they got something going.
Yeah.
Oh, that was just awful. And the hotel, they used to have a manager of that that just kept all the cobwebs, everything swept out. And I don't know if they don't have enough help or what, they don't know how. But it's just to get it going downhill. I didn't know. And we were disappointed in the dining room. And the coffee shop was closed up, wasn't it?
Yeah, they closed the coffee shop up, and the dining room has, we hate to get into fussing about it, but.
Yes. But my goodness, it had gone downhill, and the food wasn't good. We had to go into Cave City to get anything, and we traveled quite a bit. And, well, it just didn't shape up to our expectations at all. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the old hotel, it needed to be done something with. They had it as a craft shop when we were there 5 years ago, and that was all right to do it that way, but it needed some major repairs. I suppose they needed to just to do away with it.
Yeah.
But that other place is just too dirty. The first class citizens are not going to stop there if they don't get some help to clean that up.
But all in all, I'm glad it's a national park.
Uh-huh. And the park itself, aside from the accommodation.
Right.
Yes, I'm glad it is. It's worthy of being a national park. But we've stayed in some Kentucky state parks that sure are cleaned up better than Mammoth Cave National Park. We enjoy going down to Kentucky Lake, Ken Lake. Have you been there?
I haven't been there. I've heard it's nice, though.
We're hoping that I get well enough that we can go down there this fall.
And then Barclay.
I've heard that's really nice.
That is a wonderful lodge down there. We took our boat down, oh, I don't know how many years ago. Oh, not more than 7, I guess. But I tell you, Mammoth Cave ought to shape up. We love it, but it just needs to be cleaned up some.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell me about your experience at Mammoth Cave before I turn off the tape?
Oh, did you have the tape on for my show?
Yeah, if you want, I can get rid of that.
Oh, yes, you erased that.
Okay.
I thought we were just talking.
We are.
I shouldn't have said anything about that.
No one's going to.
But that's the truth.
Yeah, one's going
to. You can edit that to suit yourself. No, it was great to have worked with these people. And I have on my VCR the pictures of the old guys winding the torches. Have you ever seen any of that?
Uh-huh.
You've seen that. It was a great experience, and I would say that I can think of no other way that we could have got the cooperation of all the guides and the local people in doing it any other way than we did. just going in and being adopted, so to speak, and taking it, picking tobacco worms.
That's a really interesting story. Well, I'll go ahead and turn this off now.
Okay.